The weekend is near, and the next round of footy is finally upon us. And your ultimate guide to all the upcoming action lies within the Fox Footy Podcast Bunker. Welcome to Match Committee.
If you forgot to put your tips in for round six, bad luck. Just ask Max's girlfriend, who walked away with zero correct winners after every home team came up trumps on the weekend. It was just the latest unpredictable episode of an unpredictable AFL season where many teams are as untrustworthy as a bartender handing you an inflated tab. We'll discuss the pretenders, contenders, plus five big bumps, but no trumps on this week's edition of the Fox Footy Podcast. Ben Waterworth with you, as is the new number one ticket holder to the Andrew Phillips fan club, Max Lawton. Hello, Maxi.
We've got a lot of ticket holding going on in this podcast. And yes, correct report on Kat. She refused to put them in or forgot. You, instead of just Googling Max Lawton footy tips, as she normally does. Because I tell her, she says, oh, what are your tips this week? I say, oh, you know, just Google them. It's on the internet.
And we'll discuss later, Maxi, that your tipping at the moment is not in dire straits, but it's wavering, to say the least.
I would be Googling Tom Morris footy tips right now.
Speaking of Tom Morris and number one ticket holders, the aspiring number one ticket holder, the Isaac Rankin fan club, Tom Morris.
I love Isaac Rankin. Oh, my God. How good is that? You know when someone bursts on the scene and you just think, well, that's the next 15 years sorted. I can't wait to see what he does over the next decade or so. Ben, that's a great intro that you just delivered just then. That's probably your best intro you've ever done. There's a bit of rhyme, there's some rhymes, there was some references to obscure things. I think you're in some good form today.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. Not as good as form as Isaac Rankin, though, to the point where Gary Lyon has redone the draft and put Rankin at number three, the 2018 Future Super Draft, where he's put Rankin at number three after one game.
Well, and Sam Walsh sixth, which was interesting given he won the Rising Star last year and has played okay.
It reminds me of a batsman that makes 100 early on in their career, and the small sample size actually works in their favour, but then in the end, they end up averaging 37 and get dropped. Now, I don't think Isaac Rankin's going to get dropped or play to the equivalent of a batting average of 37, but we're certainly seduced by one performance because that's all we've seen, but he's going to be a star. I would love to see what he does on the big stage as well, because he seems like the sort of character that would perform when the pressure's on, which I really like.
Yeah, so Ben, you've watched plenty of his career, given you've watched a lot of under-18s footy, and it seems like he does this every time he steps up a level.
So he debuted in the Sandford League as a 16-year-old playing against blokes and kicked two goals on debut, and two very good goals, might I add. And then he made the under-18 All-Australian team twice, so once as a 17-year-old and then once in his top age year. And in that top age year, he produced the most incredible three quarters. I don't know if you were doing that game with me on the boundary, Tom, but Rankin was, he kicked five goals against Vic Metro to seal South Australia's championships win. It was the most breathtaking performance you could see. And he arguably,
Sarah Ollie was in that game.
And he arguably usurped it on the weekend with his first touch. And he broke James Harms' ankles with his first touch of the football.
Can I ask you guys a question without notice? And this is not part of Fair or Fast, which of course is Australia's favourite segment. What's the best, or no, I'll phrase it differently. Name a debut game that you've been more enthralled by than Isaac Rankin's.
I don't think there's been a debut game where someone has made such a monumental impact. I think back to Michael Barlow's debut in 2010 was insanely good from a numerical perspective, and he
Super
really announced himself. Yes, absolutely, but nowhere near the same extent as how Isaac Rankin's performance has reverberated around the footy community.
I can't say I was watching Daniel Metropoulos' debut, but I believe that was quite good as well.
Daniel Metropoulos, really?
Six goals on debut in 1992. I was 0 years old, so I didn't watch it, but it was rather good.
I'm trying to think. The first goal that he kicked, everyone's like, great goal, yes.
Rankin awesome. Or Metropoulos, sorry,
I'm
Tom?
I'm sorry, I'm talking about Rankin again. Okay. I know it was a fantastic finish, but I just love the intuition to bounce the ball to himself like a basketballer, and that's how he controlled the ball. He didn't just go to pick it up. He actually, in an instinctive moment, he knew that he couldn't pick it up one go, so he bounced it from his right hand into his left hand and then picked it up and then kicked the goal. That sort of thing you actually can't teach. He's just got that in his blood.
And it's good you mentioned Daniel Metropoulos, because this weekend it's the Western Derby back in Perth. Of course, they'll be playing for the Daniel Metropoulos Cup. More on that later. But what we're going to kick off this podcast with officially is the bump. And this sudden sort of unexpected surge of bumps after, you know, we talked about sling tackles a couple of weeks ago, and they sort of came in a clump. The bumps came in a clump on the weekend, with five drawing the attention of match review officer Michael Christian, and all sort of coming back with different results, Tom. Well, obviously, we're recording this hours before the big double tribunal hearing tonight, which will see Ben Long and Dylan Scheel face a tribunal. But this has sort of come out of nowhere, and Michael Christian was certainly kept very busy.
Yeah, I'm going to put my nuts on the line and give a prediction for you both. I think Dylan Scheel will get one. I don't think he'll get two. I think it'll be reduced to medium impact rather than high, which was based on the which would have remained high had the MRI come back with a fracture for Curtis Taylor, but it didn't. So that was a key part of the evidence and the reason why Essendon are challenging, as we wrote yesterday for the Fox Footy website, Max. Mm-hmm. And I think Long will get four. That's my tip. I think the fact that he raised his hips into Sean Darcy and the impact was so severe will see him get four. But I think the Saints are confident at this stage they can get it down to two or three. Three, which is amazing.
Yeah. Three sounds about right for me. I wouldn't be too disgruntled with four or even probably two, depending on how it's argued. I was in the tribunal hearing last week with Hayden Crozier, which was a very 2020 experience, as I sat there in my free Brooklyn Nets t-shirt and tracksuit pants watching eight cameras on eight suited up men, including Jeff Gleeson, the AFL's QC. That was good fun. So I agree. I think Shields a good chance to get down from two to one. Essentially, what's happened here is that he's been graded on the look of the thing, the vibe, and then the medical report has changed the reality. And Michael Christian sort of admitted this because he talked about yesterday on Monday that they want to give determinations in match review issues 24 hours after the game. And we did not have the North Melbourne medical report at that time. So now we know more, and it's well and truly possible that if the match review was held over another 24 hours and he had Curtis Taylor's medical report, he would have given medium impact and Scheel would have gotten a week and the Bombers might have accepted that.
Once the medical report lands, and this is a conversation that goes around in circles, but once the medical report lands and Christian hasn't given his verdict so far, is it right that it's automatically down to medium impact?
Well, it won't automatically be down to medium impact. That will just be the argument, and then they will assess a number of different.
But I'm saying
factors.
Christian. So, for instance, if he hadn't have sent out his initial MRO report before the medical impact was given, and if he had the medical impact with him and it had given medium impact, like surely that shouldn't be a reason, or should it be a reason why the medical report has a determination on what the impact level is?
Yes. But it's not the only determining factor. The impact level, remember now, Ben and Max, is also determined by the potential to cause harm for tackles and bumps. So I think that was taken into account. But essentially, I think what you're asking is, should Michael Christian just wait another 4 or 5 hours before delivering his verdict? And I get
conundrum.
That. But I also think the tribunal's there for a reason. And I think now that there's no further penalty in terms of weeks if you go to the tribunal and lose, I think the system in that regard actually works quite well.
Yeah, this is the system working in reality. Yeah. You may disagree with the result. The one that really bothered me from the weekend, if we're grading, I mean, so much of this, when you don't know the full medical report, is about the vibe of the thing, how it looked.
Marbo, the vibe. Yep.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. And Gary Rowan getting low impact was questionable. I think a lot of people are comparing Scheel and Rowan, asking how is one of them 2 weeks and one of them $1,000 fine. My instinct when I saw him, I think it was on Ryan Lester on Thursday night, was that he was getting suspended. So, again, it's one of those questions about the impact and the results, and it's so questionable how the system works. But it has to be, because there's no definitive way to say exactly this.
Yeah, that's right. I think an outcome-based system, I think it's slightly too skewed towards outcome. Everyone says, oh, the outcome should be irrelevant. I disagree. The outcome has to have relevance, because clearly if you punch someone and knock them out, that should be, I think, a bigger penalty than if you punch someone and you clip their chin and they continue to play the game. Not saying you shouldn't be also penalised for that, but I think the outcome has to have an impact. I just think it's probably a bit too much at the moment if I'm going to sort of give it a ratio. I think the action should be about 65 and the outcome should be about 35. At the moment, I get the feeling the action is about 40 and the outcome is about 60. And I think that's probably slightly skewed.
Well, Maxi will be following the tribunal, both tribunal hearings tonight on foxfooty.com.au if you're listening to this on late Tuesday afternoon. And if you're listening afterwards, you can get his full wrap at the Fox Footy website.
Also, sorry, can I say one more thing, Ben? Sorry.
Yes, of course, Tom.
Yeah, Ben Long, I'm sure he's a decent fella. And I preface it for a reason, because there's a lot of players that are dirty or play on the edge that are decent guys off the field. Like, it is relevant. But he has a long history of these sorts of incidents. He's not going to whack anyone behind play, but I've seen him do it several times where the ball's been in play and he's lined someone up and absolutely cleaned them up in junior footy, in the VFL. That's the reason why he couldn't play round one when he first got to St Kilda, because he got suspended late in the season before for Footscray. He has a history of playing on the edge, and it could be classified by some people as actually quite dirty or thuggish. It's just something that needs to sort out, because you can't afford to continue to play this sort of footy at a high level and miss games for this reason. That's old school to play that sort of way. I'm not saying that it's premeditated, but he has an instinct and a decision to make, and too many times he's made the wrong call. And that's part of what makes him a good player, because he's tough and he's courageous and he doesn't take a backward step. But he probably just needs to tone it down 10 or 20% to even things up.
Do you reckon that might come up in the tribunal hearing tonight?
I've got no doubt.
From the AFLQC?
Yeah, I've got no doubt. He's got a history, albeit not at the highest level, of head-high bumps and shirt fronts that would make sense in the 80s and 90s and Byron Pickett era and David Rees-Jones, but right now they're completely frowned upon. So I'm sure he's aware of it, but it's something that he needs to fix, and fix pretty soon, because he's too good a player to miss games for this sort of thing.
Let's turn our attention to the fixture and where things sit from that perspective. So late last night, the round 8 fixture was announced, and it looks like Monday night footy is going to become a bit of a regular across the rest of this condensed AFL season. And we will see Adelaide and St Kilda next Monday night. And then we'll see, I think it's Freo and Geelong on a Monday night game in round 8, Maxi. But then we're hoping that either late this week or early next week, we're going to be getting rounds 9 to 12. What was this sort of, when the fixture landed, Maxi, last night, and potentially how it might pan out, how did you see it land?
Yeah, there's a couple of notable things. I suppose Gold Coast getting a non-Saturday or Sunday game for the first time in club history was impressive. The women's side did have a Friday night game, but the fact that the Suns had never not played on a weekend was funny. Although it is still a Fox exclusive Thursday night game. That must be noted. There's a difference between
Fox exclusive, except into Queensland, yes.
Yes, of course. But there's the TV deal. It's that the amount of games that Seven shows each week is notable. Grand final rematch on Friday night. And it also seems like they're trying to get as many teams out of New South Wales as possible. This has been a bit of a development on Tuesday morning. Hawthorn is playing at the SCG against the Swans in round 8, and they're flying west. They're going to join Carlton in the WA hub. And you've also got Melbourne playing at Metricon, and I think that they might be staying in Queensland after their round 8 game. So because the cases are increasing in New South Wales, the AFL's already set itself up where it can abandon Sydney if it needs to, including getting the Giants and the Swans out of there.
I think the NRL is planning to do the same thing. I've sort of reports coming out on Tuesday morning that they want to try and relocate all their teams, Tommy, into Queensland as well. So Queensland could become quite busy. They missed out on a whole heap of tourism dollars, Queenslanders, in recent times, but they might be getting an influx of professional sporting teams.
Well, that's right. I mean, my local footy club's trying to organise a postseason trip, which is unusual given there's been zero games played. And they've decided that they can't be going to Early Beach because there'll be no backpackers there because there's no tourists. So that's something for them to consider. Not that it's that relevant for this podcast, but what the AFL's trying to do, and I think Caroline Wilson explained it well last night on Footy Classified, is they're essentially running away from the virus. So it's sort of engulfed Victoria. It's starting to look that way in New South Wales, sort of similar to what it was in Victoria maybe 3.5 weeks ago. And they just need to get somehow 17 rounds in, or everyone play 17 games by the time it engulfs too many states. You hope that Queensland and Perth and Northern Territory remain available and they'll be able to do it. But there's so many different complexities, not least of which, Ben, which we can talk about if you want, is the battle or the discussion with the players to get them to stay longer than they'd originally agreed upon, and then probably go back into hubs after that with the added complexity of families as well. It's a really difficult task for the AFL and everyone involved.
Oh, it's a horrid task. And again, we
you know, Travis Olds getting heaps of plaudits at the moment, and everyone talking about he deserves a trip to Vegas when the international borders open up at the end of the season, just to relax and calm down. But it is tough, and considering how this narrative has played out throughout 2020, the players will, I think, and they'll probably be represented by Paul Marsh and the players' union, no doubt, Tom, will probably push back on that idea of staying longer, or at least trying to get a buy round in there at some stage so they can return home briefly.
Yeah, I think they'll accept, probably begrudgingly, staying for 42 days instead of 35. A lot of talk about staying away for 32 days. In fact, it was always 5 weeks, and that's what we reported. 5 weeks was sort of the average length. That will become 6 weeks. Although the way these things work is that the AFL canvasses the plan with the clubs, and once they start canvassing plans with clubs, like, it's going to happen. They'll say, "Oh, it's just ideas and planning," but once they start speaking to club CEOs and presidents and footy managers that this is what's looking likely, you can pretty much take it to the bank. The last people to get told are the AFL Players Association, which clearly would irritate them, because what if they turn around and say, actually, the players are refusing to do this? Then all the discussions with the clubs beforehand are irrelevant. Nevertheless, that's how the league works. I think the players will accept an extra week, which will become 42 days. Anything beyond that, I think, is a real chance to be rejected by the players. And then there's an issue. But the way I've sort of done the maths, and I've looked at a physical calendar. I didn't know physical calendars existed anymore, but I've got one in my house on my fridge. And I was doing the maths. And if they stay for 42 days, that will take them up to the end of stage three, what we think will be the end of stage three restrictions in Victoria. And then they'll come back to Victoria, the Victorian clubs. And by then, you'd hope that the state governments would be more understanding of the situation here. The situation would be better, and they'd be able to potentially fly in and fly out, maybe to Perth or Darwin or somewhere like that to play, albeit looking unlikely at the moment. But these things change quickly. The issue was that if they only spent 35 days abroad, the clubs would then have essentially a blank week, like a wasted week, before August 20, I think it's the weekend of August 15, 16 or 14, 15. And that would make it really difficult for the AFL. Do they have a bye? Do the Victorian teams play each other? Like, what happens for that week? And the AFL, the one thing the AFL doesn't want, it's a wasted week given where the season is at already. So that's sort of where it's at from a broad perspective.
Max, he kind of leads us into, and I wanted to sort of bring this up a little bit, is your power rankings this week in particular, and which teams are well placed for the next month. And as I mentioned off the top, it is a really hard season. I reckon it's a fair bit to do with because we're playing at neutral venues all at the moment. It's a really, it's a shocking tipping season, and it's really hard to get your head around which teams.
Season? Is it?
I think it is, Thomas. But and I think most of the neutrals do, because it's hard to know which teams to trust. And yeah, you've kind of ruled a line out in your power rankings. The top 12 in your rankings. Anyone below that top 12 can't win the flag this season.
Yeah, and to be fair, Tom, I think if you're leading the comp, it must be a weird tipping season.
Oh, so, that pledge is not bad, Pinhead.
Just borrowing from Dan. So, it feels like there's sort of two tiers at the moment, and we sort of went through this a little bit last week, but the teams I'm happy to rule out. Adelaide's not winning the flag unless the ladder literally gets flipped on its head and for some reason it's golf. Sydney, North Melbourne, has lost four in a row. They're in trouble. Frio, I just don't believe it enough. And Gold Coast, realistically, without Matt Rowell, that's not the difference. But that is a big blow. And you saw how poorly their midfield went against the Demons on the weekend. And then probably Melbourne is a question mark. I mean, if they get it together, they could sneak into the eight. They did change their game style quite a bit against the Suns, but I still wouldn't be tipping them. But other than that, you can make a case for any team getting into the top four. And if you're in the top four, you can win the flag. We know that historically. Even Carlton, Carlton at its best this season has looked as good as anyone. The way they played against Geelong, beating Geelong is a huge scalp. The way they played against the Bulldogs was one of the most complete performances of the season. Every other team has at least an argument to be made to be in the discussion.
Yeah, the Blues were outstanding on Sunday night, and they're playing this sustainable game style at the moment, which has been widely lauded. One team that's not playing a sustainable game style at the moment is the Giants. And I found out on Sunday that the Giants had not won an inside 50 count for the entire year. And the inside 50s can be misleading. Like people will say inside 30s are better. But genuinely, what I've found is it's probably a second best metric to determine how good a team's forward half game is. Obviously, number one is time in forward half. But the Giants are second last for inside 50 differential at the moment and haven't won a count all season. Adelaide are bottom, and they actually won the inside 50s in round one against Sydney, even though they lost. But the Giants aren't playing a sustainable game style at the moment, Tommy. And it's led to some pretty interesting discussions behind the scenes, which you reported last night on the couch about team selection and Stephen Canelio potentially being discussed as a shock axing or a shock team selection statement. What's the latest there?
Yeah, well, as always, these things are a matter of balance and perspective, I guess. So, first of all, I wouldn't go with the story if I didn't trust the people I've spoken to. And the people I've spoken, and they're plural, the people I've spoken to here are very reliable. But I also must concede that not everyone feels this way at the club. I've received a couple of calls this morning, which is absolutely fine, from people very close to the situation who said, look, Tom, I think you've actually got this wrong. I don't think he's in any danger of being dropped. So, look, it's probably halfway between. I've got no doubt he's under pressure to perform. I've got no doubt he's putting himself under pressure to perform. I also honestly believe that his position in the team and his role in the team has been discussed. But I probably need to concede that I went a bit hard saying that he could be dropped this week. And that's on me. I need to be better than that, because the people that have called me this morning, not the people I spoke to yesterday, are pretty senior people at that footy club. So in saying that, their midfield has been terrible and he's sort of been shifted out of the midfield. I think in the end, what it'll do, not that my story is going to have a huge impact on the team or anything like that, but Stephen Canelio is a pretty proud person. I think he'll play well this week. And I also think that there's a suggestion, and this is speaking to people this morning as well, there's a strong suggestion that as a captain, as a new captain of a club that is not at its best, when he can't really get the whole group together to do bonding exercises or you know, train as a collective group or be a cohesive unit, that he's actually probably trying to do a bit too much at the moment as a captain, and trying to be a bit too perfect, trying to be everyone's best captain or best leader or best friend. And there certainly is a perspective within the club that he's a great fella. He's a really good player. He's on a long-term deal. He just needs to be a bit more like Stephen Canelio. You know, he needs to call a spade a spade. And I'm looking forward to seeing how he responds this week. But I think I absolutely concede, Max and Ben, that I probably went a bit hard with that story last night, and I've copped it absolutely rightfully so. The worst thing in the world is doing a story like that and people assuming that you're saying he's going to be dropped this week, when I never actually wrote that.
Which you never said.
Yeah, I never said that, but equally, it's an understandable assumption to make given the headlines and sort of the social media feedback you get. So that's sort of how my morning's been spent. I've received calls saying, I reckon you're on the money. I've received calls saying, mate, I reckon you're off the money. As always, it's about interpretation, and I take it all on board and try to be better.
Well said, Thomas. Well owned. But at the same time, you look at the numbers. And Canelio, in 2013, he averaged 19.3 disposals. And this year, he's averaging 19.8. Every other year, he's been more than 19.8. So at the moment, numerically, just looking at the numbers, he's having the second worst season of his career. And I think, Maxi, at the start of the year, and I'm not sure how much it's changed in the past couple of weeks, but he was sort of playing as a bit of a high half forward at times, and he wasn't playing smack bang in the middle of the ground. So maybe there's been a slight role change for Canelio in recent times. But last year, before he had that knee injury, he was constantly getting 30-plus disposals and hitting the scoreboard as well, to the point where Gary Lyon said he was close to the best player in the competition. And Gary actually predicted he would be the best player in the competition by season's end in 2020. But it just kind of symbolised at the moment where the Giants are at. They're just not the same team. They're, as I think it was Kingy said on First Crack on Sunday night, that they're miles off their best at the moment and miles off even looking like trying to make a grand final in 2020.
I mean, I think they're a very similar team to last year in that they are a very, very good team, but they're not a great team. And I think the fact that they made the grand final has sort of fooled everyone into thinking that they played at that level. Last year, they finished sixth. They lost 9 games. They had some very good games, like winning in Geelong and things like that, but they also had some bad ones. They had trouble scoring. They were relying heavily on scoring from stoppages, and they won 2 very close finals, in the semi and the prelim, to get to the grand final, but then they got belted because they were not as good as Richmond. And once again, they're probably around the 4th to 7th range. They're just not one of the best teams in the comp, and their midfield is down, which is making matters worse this season. I think they've won the contested possession count once all year, which is surprising when you look at their list. In my view, there's a perception of what the Giants should be because you look at their list and how incredibly talented it is and what they actually are. And I still think there's a gap between the two for most people.
Can I ask you both a question? And I might be, if this is too dramatic, please let me know. But at some stage in your football career or your coaching career or your work life or your life, your mortality flashes before your eyes and you think, geez, I'm almost done here, or I'm not far away. And footballers would get it at all different ages, and people in life get it at all different times of their existence as well.
Yours was this morning.
Mine was this morning. But I wonder whether GWS at 3-3 in a season where they were expected to contend again and anything less than maybe a prelim final is considered a failure, has its mortality flashing before its eyes. Because you have a situation where you have a really talented list. They've stockpiled talent. They're ready to go. They've been in the window now for pretty much longer than any other team. I mean, they were there in 2016 and lost to the Dogs in the prelim, and they're still there now. So they've been there longer than Richmond, for example. But it's just not working. And I just wonder how long it can continue to go on for, where they have to make a change. I mean, you're not saying you should sack Leon Cameron or rule him out now. But what if GWS comes 7th, 8th, 9th, or 10th? How long can you persist to be mediocre with a list that I think most people agree should be elite?
So are they joining the potentially on the verge of joining Hawthorn and North Melbourne? And I've heard this term a few times in the past couple of days, of joining them in no man's land, Tom.
No, well, they shouldn't. No, they're not in no man's land, because I reckon they're still going to be good next year. Whereas I question the Hawks because of their age profile, and I question the North because of their talent profile, to be perfectly blunt. But it's no longer good enough just to be a good team for GWS. You know, so sort of the time has been now. 2016 might have been a bit early, but from 2017 onwards, the time has been now. And they've made a grand final. They got pumped. I know it's hard to win a flag, but they can't continue to be up and down like this. They have to excel, or they need to make some changes.
So you go, Maxi.
Yeah, they've been good enough since 2016 that this team should win at least one flag in that 6-7 year span. 100%. Like, they've been up there the whole time. Clearly enough talent. They've been very unfortunate in certain years with injuries, but they still should. I mean, and you see this in all kinds of sports. Some of the great quarterbacks in the NFL, Aaron Rodgers, has won one Super Bowl, and he's one of the best quarterbacks of the last 50 years. You know, these things happen. I do think the Giants are a bit different from the Hawks, and I have a different view on the Hawks than most people, where the Giants can definitely still win in the next couple of years, and the Hawks are on the way down. And the Hawks have sort of set themselves up in a position where they're going to have to do a big rebuild, because they've been going all in since the three-peat, and they're spending all their chips. They're going all in every time, and eventually that has to hurt you.
Yeah, well, we talk about the Hawks. I mean, you're heavily influenced by your lovely mother, Nikki, who's a big Hawks supporter. I don't know. A 3-3, it's far from over for GWS, but they're not showing signs that they're going to be a premiership team this year. In saying that, neither did Richmond at this time of the year when they won the flag. So there's a lot of time left, but they need to start pushing soon. And weirdly, they don't have many injuries either. I know Tim Taranto's been missing, but they've pretty much got a clean bill of health. Yeah. So there's no excuse.
Well, the Giants will be heavily scrutinised and watched over the next couple of weeks at 3-3. Lots of other teams are 3-3 at the moment, including Hawthorn, which are widely discussed on the couch, and 360 last night. And we wrap that all up on foxfooty.com.au, so you can check out all the Hawks discussion there. But now, Tom, it's time for Australia's favourite segment on the Fox Footy podcast, Fair or Farce.
Great. Okay. Good to speak to you both on Fair or Farce. I'm just going through
my phone. Welcome.
And looking for something from last week. I received a very nice message.
Don't tell me that someone has slid into the DMs here with a Fair or Farce pumper.
I've got it here. So you'll never guess. You will never guess.
Is it Brett Deledio?
No, it's not Brett Deledio. So you might remember that the great woman Bethany on Instagram said, how good is this? Like, I'm on the thanks for including me on the Fox Footy podcast. Really nice of you. And then when I read that out last week, she slid in again and said, oh my God, my day's been made. I've been read out again twice. So I want to say thank you to Bethany. I really appreciate that. It's so nice. And, you know, not every day do you get fan mail, but it seems like Farrah Fast is getting fan mail.
So is this a never-ending cycle where you're going to keep congratulating her for DMing you and saying thank you, and then she gets excited about being mentioned?
She said, I think the highlight of my footy career is not being asked to co-captain my team, but being outed twice on the Fox Footy podcast for sliding into your DMs. Another cracking episode. How good is that?
Excellent.
Anyway, that's enough. That's enough fan mail for Farrah Fast, because we're going to get into it. So, Farrah Fast, Max.
Hi.
The competition is more even than it ever has been. Farrah Fast.
Very close to fair. Yeah, I haven't looked at every season to give you a definitive answer, but the fact that so many teams seem to be in the window because of how weird this season is, it has to be considered even. I mean, teams don't have a true home ground advantage, yet all the home teams won on the weekend, and there are so many teams that are close enough. There are teams that will squeak into the eight that wouldn't have otherwise because of the shortened season and because that percentage is going to be really important. It's a really weird year, and it's as open as it ever has been because of that.
Good answer, Max, I reckon.
Thanks.
No, nicely done. Ben, Farrah Fast. Coaches should not blame other coaches for making the game ugly. Farrah Fast.
Oh, this was juicy. This is juicy. No, I would say they shouldn't blame. Yeah, I'd say that's fair because I think all coaches are blamed here. But there was some interesting footage there that Maxie highlighted on foxfooty.com.au that was played on the couch last night of Damien Hardwick. Well, originally in the press conference, Damien Hardwick had a bit of a veiled swipe at the Swans for playing, for what he thought, playing too many players in Richmond's forward half. But when you actually look at it, Callum Mills was just holding his spot in defence, and Richmond actually had a spare up the field more than anything else. We've covered a lot of stashes in the past 4 months. Yeah. But I actually kind of half enjoyed this stash between the two coaches, because it is sort of getting to an issue that is I think it's a genuine issue in the game at the moment. But I think it's really more incumbent on the league at the moment, and I think I've been pretty big on this. I think it's time for them to almost take a our way or highway kind of mentality, because they've been consulting so many people over the past few years, which is great to a certain extent, but it's almost time to become a little bit more authoritative in the state of the game discussion. And actually make some big calls. And as Jared says, everyone has got their own solution. Jared Waitley, that is. Everyone's got their own solution to the state of the game, and they fastidiously and almost demonstratively think that their solution is the right one. So it's now, I think, time for the AFL to actually make a definitive call on what is the solution in their eyes. Make a call, and everyone works to it and tries not to complain afterwards.
Yes, I agree, Ben. But fair or fast, coaches should not blame other coaches for making the game ugly.
They're fair.
Good. No, everything's easy. Bang on. Yeah, and we do love a stoush as well, especially when it's legitimate like that. I mean,
yeah, legitimate stoush.
Is legit. This is not manufactured. Max, fair or fast? Clubs should continue to call out racist social media comments toward players.
Fair. As always, when these stories happen, I think Harley Bunnell was the most recent one over the weekend. People say, oh, this is what they want. They want attention. Sure, but the only way that everyone is going to learn that this stuff is completely unacceptable is if we use our platforms like media outlets and football clubs to call it out and say, this is not okay. It's what other codes do. It's what other sports do. They're really strong on this sort of stuff. The AFL needs to continue to be this way because it's really, really important.
Yeah, I've my opinion on this, just to throw my two cents in, has flipped. So I think previously in the camp, to be honest, where I thought, well, why should we call it out? That's all they want is attention. But I've actually noticed a significant strength of power, I think, a power shift, I think, certainly this year in particular, and I reckon even more so since the Black Lives Matters movement has grown in prominence. There is a big power in calling it out, and you're right, Maxie, with personalities and organisations that have decent followings, I think it's more than ever, they have the power to create trying some social change. So I'm now all for calling it out, and I think certainly us as an organisation, as Fox Sports, has a role to play in that as well.
You see it in the NFL. The Washington NFL team is changing its name finally after years of people. I didn't want to say it on purpose, Tom, because it's offensive, but they're finally...
Sorry, that was a question. I actually didn't... I assumed... Okay. Sorry, if I've offended anyone, I apologise.
It's okay. I understand. It's a very different situation using it here, to be fair, than it is in the US, but
yes.
They are... financial pressure has essentially forced them to change it because their big sponsors have said, hey, we want you to change this. So the reality of our society is that money is going to dictate these things a lot more most of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, if there's commercial pressure, then there's no doubt that businesses will fold far easier than if there's just social pressure. That's just the reality of the economic world. I'm up to Ben, fair or fast? If everyone can't play everyone else once, the season is too compromised. Fair or fast?
No, that's a farce because the season is we have become known as a competition for being compromised and unfair because we've always had a 23-round season with 18 teams and everyone plays each other once, but then there's a couple of extra double-ups on top of that. So no, I understand it's not like the AFL fastidiously wants to hold on to everyone plays each other once. How the COVID numbers and spikes and outbreaks are sort of trending at the moment, I just think we've got to get into our heads that if we have to go away from everyone playing each other once, like that was our ideal situation and a great time to trial it, certainly this year. But now I think we've got to try and get away from that mindset, considering that the AFL themselves have said they've got to be agile and flexible. And
okay, so Ben, how much of an adjustment to the season is too much? Like, what's your threshold where you go, actually, this is ridiculous?
Well, teams are going to play each other three times. That's probably a bit ridiculous. But if we've got... Yeah, no, teams can double up this season. There's nothing wrong with that.
Let's think left field. Let's say, for example, there's a big outbreak and they say, okay, the top two in the ladder are playing a grand final and that's the Premier. Do you think that would be compromising the season too much?
Not too much, but I can also understand people who would then say that it's not a real season. But ultimately, in a already weird season, you've earned the right there to be at the top. Like if you finish in the top two, like you've got the best chance, Maxi, of making the grand final from there. Your odds are great, so you've earned that right. So I still think it's legitimate in that sense.
Yeah, and we're always going to have the understanding that this season came with a weird context. So there's not going to be, maybe in 1,000 years, we'll forget that the 2020 AFL season was weird, but we're going to remember it for a long time. And with the double up question that you actually posed as the fair or farce, I mean, that's going to have an impact maybe on the edge of the eight. Maybe a team gets in because they got to play Adelaide twice, for example, instead of playing a game against GWS or Richmond, someone like that. But do we really think that the best team is going to not win the flag because of the fixture, because of a couple of games? It's not maybe the second or third best team might win instead because there was a bit of an advantage from home ground, but is that big of a problem if that happens? Could we really tell for sure that was the wrong Premier winning? We've had teams that weren't the best team all year winning the flag before. Richmond wasn't the best team in 2017, and then they won the flag. Geelong in 08.
I think what no one's talking about is how finals are going to look, and because we don't know, obviously. Yeah. But as long as you have 4 weeks of finals, 8 teams in finals, then the best team will win. I think that is crucial. But what happened before then, as long as you get enough games in to sort of get a decent sample size, is not irrelevant, but it's absolutely secondary to having a 4-week final series.
Tommy, I have to say as well, though, that Maxie mentioned it before, whoever does play Adelaide this year twice, if that does come to fruition, we'll have a significant advantage because I am flabbergasted by how bad the Crows are. Like they're genuinely an 18th team. And I would say there's a gap between 18th and 17th this year. Yeah. Who's 17th in your power rankings, Maxi?
Sydney, but only because of all their injuries, not talent.
There's a gap. There's a decent gap between Adelaide and Sydney, I'd recommend.
Interesting that Matthew Nix conceded, I think it was last week or the week before, that he's not getting the support in terms of quantity of coaches that he would have liked after COVID. And I think for a first-time coach to say that just shows that how difficult it is to walk into a footy club in the best of times, let alone when they're rebuilding and losing and he's lacking staff members around him.
Tom, do you think it would make sense for John Worsfold to go to the Crows next year?
As a mentor?
As a mentor, as an assistant, as a senior, as a head
of coaching. Yeah, absolutely. I think John Worsfold's a perfectly balanced person to do that. I haven't thought of that, Max, but I think that would make perfect sense. Yeah.
There's a bit of momentum growing for that because he did a really good job when, obviously, the passing of Phil Walsh, and he was able to help Scott Camporeale through the back half of that season. And they reckon he might be able to go back and do the same with Matthew Nix.
I also think that he'll go back to Perth with his family. But yeah. I think from a football perspective, that would make sense. The other thing that's bubbling away and has been for a while is Ross Lyon. Like, how long is he going to be out of the coaching game for? I speak to people, they say that he's done, and other people say that he's really keen to get back in. So a bit like what I was talking about before with Cornelio, you don't quite know who to believe sometimes, but it's just, I watch this space. I guess there might not be an opening. Two more, Max, fair or fast. Luke McDonald should be embarrassed about his sledge to Connor McKenna.
Fair, and I think he was because he apologised. I think he understood that that's a boundary this year in particular that you don't cross because people are dying from this disease and you should not be making light of that situation. And it was a terrible thing where Conor McKenna had to deal with not just the medical repercussions, but the scrutiny that it put him under from the media and from how it impacted the entire AFL world. So I think that whole thing's been handled pretty well. He called and apologised and we all move forward understanding that some things you just don't make jokes about, really.
What do you think, Maxi, of the comparisons between Sam Mitchell's jab at the Bombers in 2015 compared to Luke McDonald's one?
I can definitely see the comparison. I think there's a time that it's almost an argument of Luke McDonald was too soon, to use a phrase we use constantly in the office. whereas the Sam Mitchell one did come at a slightly different time after all that. And, you know, he got told off. He got a please explain for that whole situation from memory. So I think that was handled in a similar fashion.
If I can put my two cents into this fair or fast question, I agree with you, Max. I think it's been handled well by North Melbourne and Luke McDonald in response. But I don't see the comparison with Sam Mitchell and Essendon. I mean, the comparison with this to me is sledging someone if they've had cancer and recovered from cancer. The COVID-19 is an illness that has killed more than 500,000 people around the world. It is a disease. And comparing it to anything else is completely missing the point. We're so blasé about it, some people are so blasé about it. Would anyone sledge anyone about an illness they've just recovered from? And I would say the answer is no to that. And Sam Mitchell's was more about a club completely mishandling its players from a welfare perspective, but no one was in any danger of dying. Whereas COVID-19 is killing people. And I think the comparisons to other, and I'm a big fan of Ralphie, but he made the comparison on TV to Sam Mitchell, and I thought that is just so far off the mark. But I must also say, when I first saw this incident on Saturday night, I thought, oh, it's nothing really. It took me about 18 hours to evolve my thinking and think of a comparison. And to me, the comparison is an illness that kills you, because that's what COVID-19 is.
Yeah, fair enough. That's a very good point.
Can kill you, sorry. It doesn't always kill you. I understand that's a bit dramatic. Ben, last one to you. Fair or fast, new football boot technology is worth exploring to improve skills in the game.
You've done some shameless things to promote your own story to pass, Tom. This is right up there. But I have to say it's fair. And gosh, Eddie really has driven this, hasn't he? This is the power of the media, and the power of Eddie has to be said as well on display, because in the past month, he's really gone on about how plastic on plastic, so that the plastic footy on the plastic footy boots has led to some pretty poor kicking, or certainly contributing to that. But no, I think it's fair. So and you can tell us more specifically about the tape, Tom. But you put this tape on your footy laces, and it grips the football a little bit more, and hopefully improves kicking efficiency and kicking accuracy as well. So if it from a legal perspective, if it's not cheating or anything like that, absolutely we should try and explore it, because, you know, you speak to someone like Nick Del Santo, who he's like every footy pundit has a bit of a gripe with the game or something that they campaign hard about. Del Santo's is clearly poor skills. So I'd be interested to get his take on this as well, about whether it's worth pursuing, but I'm all for it.
I think it's related to congestion as well. I mean, that's another topic altogether. That's another state of the game discussion. But it's called Pinpoint Kicking Aid. It's just been approved by the AFL. In fact, it was going to be approved before COVID. It sort of got put on the back burner. It's been approved now. And now these two guys are going around to different clubs and letting players trial this adhesive strip that sticks over your laces and, yeah, provides further grip. People say, like, Wayne Carey replied to Fox Footy's tweet and said, oh, this is ridiculous. And yeah. you have other former players saying this is just more practice will make better. Well, the reality is, why would the game starve itself of a tool that is apparently proving to make kicking better? I mean, it's like saying you're going to use an old wooden three wood instead of one of the brand new three woods on the golf course. Or what? Why would you use a toothpick Don Bradman bat weighing £2.3 rather than a nice big meaty one weighing £2.9 that's nicely weighted? I mean, technology evolves, and if this can improve everything 15 or 20%, all it's meant to do is just reduce the margin for error. So you can still miss targets, but it's not going to slide off the side of your foot as easily. I think that's the idea of it. So I've never used it myself, but I'll be interested to see what feedback we get from AFL clubs and if and when they start using it.
Now, so, Tom, you said that the AFL has approved this. Does that mean a club could use this weekend?
Yes. Yep. Clubs are using them at training. I think there's 5 clubs, I said in the story. Clubs are trialing it at training, and if they want to, they can use it on the weekend. Yep.
Wow.
Back to the original point, though, Tom, you'd still probably take Don Bradman with a toothpick over most batsmen, though.
Well, that's right, yes. But I'm talking about the tools they're using at their disposal to perform at the highest level. But, yeah, Don Bradman hit 6 sixes in his test career, and that's just because of the boundaries with a fence. It's just because you don't need to hit the ball in the air, Ben. You can just hit the ball on the ground and it's fine. Anyway, that's the end of Fair or Fast.
That was a strong edition of Fair or Fast. You're downplaying it off.
And thank you for all the fan mail for Fair or Fast as well. If you want to slide in, CRMorris32 on Instagram and tell us how much you love Fair or Fast.
Gosh. Well, speaking of interaction with fans, Maxi, you put the call out for some questions. And we've covered a wide range of topics already, but anything sort of take your fancy from the pundits?
Yes, from the mailbag. I mean, I get a lot more mail than Tom does, so clearly I'm more popular. That's
yes, you are.
Put it. Elaine, let's start with her question. Why wasn't Aidan Corr reported for pushing Todd Marshall's head into the ground in Port v GWS? I thought the head was protected.
Well, he was sighted, and this was picked up, I think, the day after, really, because I was watching the game, and I must admit it sort of went past me. But it was actually when the MRO findings for Sunday's games were released on Monday, this was actually assessed by match review officer Michael Christian, but in the end I've got the email here. Contact between Corr and Marshall from the second quarter was assessed. It was a view of the match review officer that Corr's actions did not constitute a reportable offence and no further action was taken.
I kind of think that's rubbish. That was a dirtier act than most of those bumps this weekend. He just drove his head face first into the grass.
Dirtier, but not as dangerous.
No, but in terms of the action rather than the outcome, you can't do that. You do that to someone in the street, you get arrested.
Was there a reversal or a free kick?
I don't think there was.
I'm happy to be told I'm incorrect, but I remember thinking to myself, that should be a reversal, and the umpire didn't reverse it. I would prefer a reversal and a fine for that sort of action. What right does anyone have when someone is laying on their stomach with their head facing towards the grass to push their head further into the ground? I think it's just a dirty act that deserves a fine and a reversal or a free kick. I'm not sure it's worth a suspension.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. James Ansell actually references a very interesting article that the ABC put up this week. I wanted to see what you guys thought about it.
I have read this, yep.
Should TV broadcasters start showing different camera angles more frequently so viewers can see and understand how the modern game is being played? Tom, you read this piece on the ABC.
Yeah, interesting piece by Russell Jackson, who's a very good journalist. He's written books. He's a cricket journalist. He also supports St Kilda.
Good for him.
I was just trying to give you some background on the journalist because it's a little bit off Broadway, but it was a piece that got me thinking. I would say no, because I think although there is an obligation to educate, and that's why we have the lab, and that's why we have expert commentators that try to teach people what they're watching. The primary obligation for a broadcaster is to entertain, in my view, because for every one footy nerd that wants to learn, and we are nuffies and nerds that want to learn every single little bit about the intricacies of the game, there are, I would say, 50 people that like sitting on the couch with a beer or having dinner with their mates, watching it casually and sort of tuning in and out from their consciousness. You know, they're sort of having discussion and they watch it for a bit and they keep talking. And I don't think we need to have a deep dive via obscure camera angles or unusual camera angles for those sorts of people. You would absolutely alienate those sorts of people. What I do think we need to have in football, and I guess this is a matter of money, is there needs to be some sort of article or TV show that is a deep dive into the tactical side of the game. But I'm not sure that doing it on game day with camera angles behind the goals and in different positions is the right way to go about it.
That's really interesting, Tommy. The balance between entertaining and like tactically informing. I think Ralphie tweeted something interesting, sort of in response to it as well. Is that fans, from feedback that he had seen, fans didn't want as much specific, dense tactical stuff. The odd flicking down the ground view was also a little bit disorientating for them as well. So it's this balance, I think, is interesting. And I remember, like, in the old sort of before Fox Footy was revamped in 2012, there was a show on Fox Sports, I remember, that the Kingy and Lynchy used to do. There was AFL Insider, which was a heavily driven tactical show. And I really, really enjoyed it. But I think the thing was that it wasn't as much, it wasn't as heavily watched as some of the other shows, like a 360 was, because it probably went above and beyond the general footy fan. However, the heavy footy fan is probably someone that has Fox Footy as well. So yeah, I think on the couch, you know, I love couch, but I think it finds a really nice balance between talking about, you know, the entertainment and being entertaining, but also diving in with numbers and vision. I think that's a really nice balance that it finds. But it's tough for broadcasters and the AFL. It's a tough balance to strike.
Yeah. Fun fact, I was a cameraman on an episode of AFL Insider.
Were you? Yes. Were you really?
They got me on one of the cameras that barely moved. I think I was on Rodney Eade's camera that episode.
Say one more thing about that discussion? It is an interesting article. Russell Jackson, have a look at it. It's on the ABC website and look it up on Twitter. It's what is the obligation to pander to the lowest common denominator? And I don't mean lowest common denominator in a negative way. I just mean the footy fan that doesn't really care about the intricacies of the game. Or is the obligation to adhere to the highest common denominator? And I think getting a balance somewhere in between is about right. We're biased, but I think Fox Footy find that balance. Clearly, Channel 7 as a free-to-air broadcaster is probably more generic and less specific because more people because everyone has Channel 7, so they have more casual fans.
Yeah.
It's an interesting discussion that we sort of constantly wrestle with as well in online and in newspapers. I mean, who are you writing your articles for? And it's impossible to throw a wide blanket over everyone.
There was, I thought there actually was some improvement on the weekend in terms of showing wide angles and from the colour commentators as well. Jimmy Bartel in the Sydney-Brisbane game had some really good comments, and then he sort of explained what was happening, and then there was a certain other play-by-play commentator who wanted to talk about jumper numbers instead, which was an interesting moment. But you've also got to keep in mind that the AFL wants to build brands out of players to a degree. You know, people complain. The footy nerds I follow on Twitter complain about why are we showing these tight camera angles on players' faces and tattoos. It's like, yeah, because Dustin Martin is the biggest brand in the AFL because he is a big personality and a celebrity. And that helps that. That helps footy expand to a more general audience. That's got to be part of it too.
Yeah, I agree. Good question from that person.
Yes. We have one here from Dallas, which is a fitting name given the question. American here. Will we see another AFL match in the USA? AFL's been making a push for more viewers there, has contracts with Fox Sports and ESPN on top of Mason Cox.
I'll answer this one. So GWS and Essendon were slated, and I think we reported on the Fox Footy website before COVID, the Giants and Essendon were slated to play a game in LA or San Francisco on a ground that would be built by the ICC for a future T20 cricket tournament. If you know what cricket is over there, Dallas, it's a game similar to baseball, except they bowl with a straight, they pitch with a straight arm.
Anyway, please keep going.
But that has now been put on the back burner due to financial reasons. I still think the Giants will be the first team to play a home game in the USA. They've got a strong connection with California. That the reason, as we said it before on the podcast, the reason Giants Stadium is called Giants Stadium and not named after a sponsor is because a group of wealthy businessmen and entrepreneurs in America simply decided to name the stadium that and pay the club the money they wanted that would otherwise be paid by a sponsor. So they have a connection with California. There's a flight over there you can get clearly. I think it's a 16-hour flight. You can get to LA from Melbourne. I'm not sure what it is from other cities, but it's similar. So there's an appetite for it, but I think that will be on the back burner now. I'd be surprised if it happened at any time in the next 3 years.
That makes a lot of sense. And then we'll have one this. Brad has a question about the Crows. What would you do differently to help them with their rebuild compared to what they're doing so far?
The rebuild's only just started as well.
Yeah.
So it's probably, there's nothing that needs to change in that sense. But I would personally like to see, and this has been a common call from pundits over the past couple of weeks, I'd like to see some more younger guys in that midfield and mix up the centre bounce a little bit more. We constantly see Crouch and Sloan in that centre bounce. I mean, obviously won't now for a little bit because Rory Sloan's had an injury setback, but it's a really good time to see Chase Jones get a good crack in there, Ned McHenry get a good crack in there, see a little bit more of Miles Boholke in there. It would have been nice to see Jordan Gallucci, who was one of their top picks from a couple of years ago, but he's out for the rest of the season. But just mix up that midfield brigade more than anything else and blood a couple of those younger players. From a key perspective, we're seeing Elliot Himmelberg play a little bit more. Fisher McAzee, who was their top pick last year, was played as a forward, but I think he's a natural defender. So I think we're already seeing Matthew Nix trial a few things, but specifically mix up that centre bounce brigade and it'll be good for Crows fans to see.
Yeah. Ben Keyes has been a good little find playing a tagging role. He's been probably one of their better players this year.
And they picked him up for nothing. So that's been a really good find for the Crows.
Yep. Should we do one more from Daniel Thorson?
One more.
Who asks, are Essendon a genuine premiership contender?
Oh.
They are 4-1 with a game in hand, so they could well be tied for top of the ladder if they had played Melbourne. You'd think they'd win that game too.
And that loss was by 1 point to the Blues as well, Tom. There's lots of good positivity about the Bombers at the moment.
I really like the Bombers. I never thought I'd utter that sentence, but I like the way they're playing. I like that they've found a way to win against the odds without Zach Merritt. They're going to find a way to win now, probably without Dylan Scheel. Things are working well for them. They're a contender because they're in the hunt like probably 12 other teams, and they're probably in the middle of that pack. But they're having a reasonable season. Long way to go, but they've certainly exceeded my expectations.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're a premiership contender yet. They are by default because they're in the race, like you said, but they don't feel like an A-grade top-level team to me. They haven't been that impressive in their wins. The Collingwood win was very good, probably their best, and they had some good signs against North on the weekend too. I reckon that's it for the mailbag, Ben.
That is it for the mailbag, Maxi. We'll finish this week's podcast with the Round 7 Tips and Cups, and there are some absolute cracking cups up for grabs this weekend, starting with one of your favourite cups, Tom, Geelong and Collingwood on Thursday night for the Carl Steinfort Cup.
For the listeners, can we, unless we want to go on Facebook Live, can we get a leaderboard update, please, just so we know who's who and who's where?
You're winning and we're not, Tom.
Yes.
Yeah, how many did you get in the weekend, Tom?
I got 5, I think.
Yeah, no, I think you'd still be on. You went into the weekend with a 1-tip lead, so I think you've definitely held that.
I believe I got 5 as well, so I think I've kept touch with you.
I got 3, so
Ben, what happened there? Who's the biggest? What's the biggest regret out of all the tips you had on the weekend and got it wrong?
I think I went with. I think I went with North Melbourne.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Enjoy that.
Yeah. It's close.
I'm going for Oh, geez, it's a hard game to tip.
Great Thursday night game.
Yeah, great Thursday night game. Oh, it's a really hard game to tip, actually. Well, who did Collingwood play last week? They won.
They kept Hawthorn to 3 goals.
Yeah, they were good, Collingwood. But Geelong were also really impressive against Brisbane. And they've got
that was one really good quarter from the Cats more than anything. I think Brisbane was more in that game than people thought. And obviously, I'm going to say this as a pessimistic Cats fan.
I'm going for Collingwood here.
I'm leaning Geelong. But once again, Ben, you've rostered me on a Thursday night when I have to watch my team play. And it makes me very anxious.
Yes. Apologies about that.
You've only been doing it for 5 years, Max. I'm sure you've.
Well, I'm never going to get used to it.
Essendon and the Bulldogs for the Mark Alvey Cup. Mark is one of the great sort of AFL Twitter community contributors. His cup is up for grabs this weekend on Friday night.
I'm very confident the Dogs will win this. If there's ever a team that has that defines the rebound philosophy, the rebound effect more, it's than the Dogs. I haven't met them because I haven't seen them because they're so tightly wound emotionally. So when they're off, they're terrible, but when they're on, they're just insatiable. And I think they'll beat Essendon, who I think are good, but I think they're probably due a loss, a bit like Brisbane were due a loss last week.
Yeah, and Dylan Shields a bigger out than people think. He was in Brownlow contention on the fringes, but he's had a very, very good season. So Bulldogs for me too.
The Giants and the Lions for the Jake Barrett Cup.
Another great game. The Giants will. Where's this game be, please, Ben?
Giants Stadium. I didn't want to yell
it. Yeah. I'm going for the Giants here. I think they'll respond. I really do.
I distinctly remember last year they played this exact fixture and the Lions were very impressive on a Sunday evening. So I'm going to tip Brisbane again.
At Giants Stadium, that was a game where they really announced themselves. The Swans and the Suns for the Nick Malcheski Cup.
Suns for me.
Yeah, the Swans are in a real bad spot.
Oh, with Kennedy and Heaney going out, it's disastrous for Sydney. Richmond,
but Buddy's going to walk back in that team and look around and go, "I'm sorry, who are you? Tom Papley's there, but there's not many others."
Yeah. Tom Papley's leading the Coleman in this team that has no players over 190 centimeters. Basically, it's ridiculous.
Tom Papley's one of my favourite players. God, I love him. I love the way he plays.
Richmond and North Melbourne for the Robin Nahas Cup.
Richmond for me.
Yeah, I was not impressed with Richmond against Sydney, but still, I still think they win this.
Carlton and Port Adelaide for the time-honoured Barnaby French Cup.
Oh, yes.
Who's playing Port Adelaide and who?
Carlton.
That matters for your tip, I guess.
I was too busy thinking about Barnaby Joyce.
I knew you were going to say that, Tom.
Who's had an indifferent political time of recent of late. Yeah, don't want to get too political on this. Although I must say, Joe Biden is the most uninspiring presidential candidate of all time.
Sorry. Let's not do that, Tom.
He's probably the best of the two, though, I'd say. Although, Kanye West is... okay, anyway, sorry, go on. No, Port Adelaide, I'm tipping here. I love Port.
Kanye's an anti-vaxxer. Port.
Hawthorn and Melbourne for the Jack Fitzpatrick Cup.
Hawthorn, don't get seduced by Melbourne last week. They got the job done and they benefited from some better selection calls, but Hawthorn will just squeeze Melbourne and they'll win.
Yeah, Hawthorn is 3-3 games next 2 weeks against Melbourne and Sydney, and they've got six more games to come against teams they beat last year.
That's a good stat. Is that Nicky Lawton or Max Lawton?
That's Max. That's all Max.
Jeez, I thought you sound like a boy. Yeah.
Fremantle and the West Coast Eagles, the Western Derby, footy back in Perth for this one. This is, of course, for the Daniel Metropolis Cup.
West Coast.
This is as close as I've felt about a derby for quite a while.
Okay. Tom didn't think that way.
No, Fremantle not going to win three in a row. They started terribly against St Kilda. I know they came home strong, but I think West Coast will win this. They're playing better footy. They're not there yet, but they're starting to put their wheels are starting to move.
Yeah. No, I agree that I don't think Freo wins three in a row, but I'm closer to tipping the Dockers as I have been for a while. Okay. So West Coast.
Doesn't matter who you're close to tipping.
Have you not realised this is what I do, Tom? I talk up the team I'm not going to tip.
Yeah, and you're tipping struggling as a result. You need to be more resolute in your tips,
Max.
And then Monday night footy returns. Adelaide and St Kilda for the Fergus Watts Cup.
I'm really close to tipping Adelaide here. We're doing this podcast... We're doing this podcast on Tuesday afternoon, and this game is on Monday. This is a long time away, and I'll take just like Ben Brown, I will take my allotted time to the max. But at this stage, I'm not brave enough to tip St Kilda, and I have said in the past that I'm not tipping Adelaide till they give me a reason to. So that's the status quo. But I'm not against a late change on Thursday night, Ben.
Sorry, sort of Chris Scott style.
Yeah.
Wait, you're considering Adelaide?
Yeah, just because it's at the Adelaide Oval, and I don't rate the Saints there at all. And this, yeah,
Did you see the Crows last time they played at the Adelaide Oval? They lost by about 1,000 points.
Yeah, it's a lot of points. Look, I'm going to tip St Kilda, but I just want to tell you that an upset wouldn't completely shock me.
Okay, well, I've said that about every other game, so fair.
I've just done what you do, yeah.
And that means, Tommy, that Couch and 360 will be on next Tuesday instead of next Monday?
Yes, so first crack Sunday night after bounce, and then the game on Monday night, and then 360 and Couch on Tuesday night. So it's all happening, but it's good that footy's back, and it's great to speak to you both.
Footy's back, it's humming, and so is this podcast. And keep clicking back, of course, as always, to foxfooty.com.au.